everybody. Welcome back to Smart Mouth. This is your host, Catherine Spires, and we have an episode from Santa Barbara County, which is exciting for me. I went to college here, and it's interesting to come back as an adult and maybe get a fuller experience of it. We were in the town of Santa Barbara, but now we're in North County, in the town of Los Olivos specifically today, with John Cox. Hi, John.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me on today.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. You are the chef and partner at The Bear and the Star, which is the restaurant at the Fess Parker Wine Country Inn.
That's right. We're here in downtown Los Olivos, so you can't miss this. Los Olivos is a pretty tiny little
town. Yeah, downtown means two street, one intersection.
That's right. You can walk around pretty quickly down here.
Yeah, it's so cute. It's adorable. And Fess Parker is like a name that I think a lot of people would recognize. It would be like, where do I recognize that from?
Right. So here locally, Fess Parker is known as kind of a real estate visionary, but on a wider scale, he was one of the first Disney actors. He played roles like Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone, and really was that like iconic Western character in a lot of the movies that you saw.
Yeah. Yeah. The old timey Westerns.
Exactly.
He was a cowboy.
He was.
And it's kind of interesting that in his actual real life, well, actually, I don't know, his grandchildren are cowboys and cowgirls for sure. But was he, or did he just like living in the country?
You know, that's a great question. I know he grew up in San Angelo, Texas and Fort Worth. So there was certainly an element of that country, and he loved the ranch. He loved the open land and cattle and horses, but I don't know how much he personally did. For example, Katie will tell you that he always wanted to have a horse ready to saddle up in the stables, but his preferred method was a vintage Humvee that he would just kind of idle along the 800 acres and, you know, look out at the pastures. So I think he was much more into that mode of transportation than horseback, at least by the time Katie was doing her horses.
Fair. He was an older man by that point.
That's right.
He just liked the quiet, maybe, just being alone. The restaurant is and the ranch and the hotel, it's almost like a vertically integrated business. It seems like you took us to the farm and the ranch this morning, and that was amazing. So tell us about like how you're not just a cook in the kitchen. You're like a cook out on the land as well.
Right. So the Fess Parker Winery is going on its 30th anniversary next year. Mm-hmm. So it really was one of the original wineries in this area. And the ranch that I took you up to this morning is a little over 800 acres. So in addition to growing grapes, they've been growing Wagyu cattle for the last few years. We just introduced sheep and quail. One of Fess Parker's grandsons, Chris, has a brewery called Third Window down in Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's the Fess Parker Winery that's been going for a while. So when I came aboard about a year and a half ago, beyond just opening the Bear and Star restaurant, one of my major goals was to start integrating all these different exciting projects that various grandkids had going on. There's so many exciting things happening within the Parker family that I felt like it'd be very natural to create a restaurant that showcased some of those products and create some more products to bring into that. So that's where we brought in the quail, the chickens. We started finishing the Wagyu beef on grape pumice and spent grains from the brewery. So when you say vertical integration, I think a lot of times that's a little bit of a dirty word that we use for institutional farming.
I just think it's smart.
It is smart. Yeah. I mean, you think about like vertical integration when it comes to manufacturing, where you control the supply chain and you also control the production.
Yeah.
But for us, or for me as a chef, the beauty behind vertical integration is that we keep more in the community.
Yeah.
So whether we're raising the grapes and then making the wine, in a way that's vertical integration. It's even more so if you're raising the grapes, making the wine, and then serving that wine in your restaurant.
Yep.
So outsourcing is great, and it's an important part of a lot of industries, restaurants included. But the more you outsource, the more jobs, the more resources leave the community. So
right.
For me, that's a real reason why vertical integration is an important thing to consider for us.
And especially when you're in a community like this, that's actually really small, people notice stuff like that, like whether you're offering jobs to people or not.
Exactly. This community is about 45 minutes outside of Santa Barbara, but it really feels like one of the wildest parts of California that I've been. We're right up here with the mountains, pastures coming down into these little tiny wine villages. And it's a very agrarian landscape. You see cattle grazing by the side of the road. You see rows of vineyard. This whole area is defined by agriculture and by tourism and by restaurants. So what we do at the Bear and Star and at the Fess Parker Winery directly shapes the landscape in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to keep those jobs. We want to keep this a working, creative community.
That seems like, I mean, you go about your business day to day, but like also maybe that's a little bit of pressure that maybe people in bigger cities don't worry about as much. Like you have eyes on you.
There is a lot of pressure being in any small town, I think. You're always under a little bit of a microscope.
Yeah.
But I think it's also nice because on the flip side, everything that you do in a small community, it's much easier to see the long-term benefits and, you know, ramifications.
Yeah.
You know, we can watch the restaurant and the ranch grow, and we can also watch how that, you know, trickle-out effect improves the community, hopefully.
That must be like a gratifying feeling.
Yeah.
However, I will say that it is kind of funny that you went as far away as possible while still living in Santa Barbara County in terms of where you live.
That's right. I get the best of both worlds because I live on a boat inside the Santa Barbara Harbor. And a lot of times, especially during the summer, I'll wake up and it'll be like a beautiful blanket of fog covering the Santa Barbara Harbor. And I'll drive for 10 minutes getting right up over the pass. And then it's just, you know, 85 degrees, sunny. And ultimately, that's what makes this part of the world such an amazing wine region, is that we have these east-west mountains where all that coastal influence comes in every day. So I guess my commute is kind of a little microcosm of that. I get the cool nights, the hot days, and it's great for grapes and great for chefs.
Definitely. Do you have to bring costume changes with you everywhere you go because the climate changes like 5 times over the course of your day?
Oh, I probably should, but.
And I want to go back to one term that you used, pumice. Is that how it's pronounced?
Right.
Like the stone, but not the stone and spelled differently.
Right, not the stone and spelled differently. So that is the main byproduct of the winemaking process. So once all the grapes have been pressed and all the juice is out of them, you'll have, depending on what wine you're making, you'll have some stems, you'll have a lot of seeds, you'll have skins, and that all still has valuable nutrients inside. So sometimes it'll go to compost, sometimes it'll just get scrapped. But for us, the winery produces almost 1 million pounds of grape pumice a year. So we're incorporating that into the cattle feed program.
Mm-hmm.
And we use it in tandem with spent grains from Third Window Brewing. So when you combine those pressed grapes,
mm-hmm.
After we've put them through a fermentation process called silaging on the top of the property,
mm-hmm.
Essentially that's just burying the grapes for a few months so that the enzymes start to break them down and make them more accessible for the cattle. We'll mix that with spent grains, which is like almost the same product, but on the brewery side.
Okay.
After the grains have been fermented and pressed, that's the shells and husks that are left over. We'll take those two products and combine them. And that makes up about 80% of our cattle feed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 1 million pounds of raw product with valuable nutrients that the cattle absolutely love. And it's a great feed for them that we keep out of the waste stream. So
I feel like they're really fancy cows. They literally get fed grapes.
They are. And they're really happy. The way that we introduce them to it is just to, we weren't sure if feeding cattle grapes and spent grains was going to work. We'd heard of other people do it, but you never know until you try it. So, you know, you put out a trough that has some corn and some grains, like a traditional feed mix.
Uh-huh.
You have some hay, you have this new silaged feed. And we were really excited to see that the cows took to it right away.
Ooh.
We didn't know what percentage of the feed we'd be able to transition to, but
yeah.
They've absolutely loved it, which is great.
Who doesn't like grapes? So it's interesting that you're from Texas, which has a long and proud barbecue tradition. And it's different from like the Southeast because that's really saucy barbecue and Texas doesn't do sauce that way. And you came to like the one part of California, the Central Coast, that likes meat the same way. And if we can say that California has like a Western style barbecue tradition, it's in this area, Santa Maria, which is very close by.
Right. The Santa Maria barbecue it's very unique, and it originated with a lot of Spanish field workers doing quick, quick lunches, out on the range. If you've spent much time in the Santa Maria Valley, you know how windy it is. And we have these grills called Santa Maria grills that have giant wheels on one side so that you can raise and lower the grates over a live oak fire. And that's really important when you're making a fast lunch and a big breeze picks up, because you can have embers that all of a sudden turn into 2 foot tall flames.
Oh, so you can
crank that wheel and get your tri-tips out of the flames, or you can lower it down and let them slow smoke. It's really a grill that's been tailored to the climate out here. And I also like to say that, you know, chefs in Santa Maria have it pretty easy, because when you go to Texas and you're cooking brisket, the pit masters are getting up at 4 a.m. and seasoning their briskets and getting them on the pit to cook for 12 or 14 hours. And out here we can wake up, you know, an hour and a half before lunch service and get some tri-tips on the grill and have them ready to go.
Yeah. So that kind of leads into my next point. Your restaurant is called The Bear and the Star because it's the state emblem of California and the state emblem of Texas. So you're kind of like fusing two traditions together in your menus, but you are Texan originally.
Right. So seventh or eighth generation, I'm not sure which, born in Dallas, my granddad still lives there. And a lot of my personal culinary history, you know, what my grandparents or my parents would have prepared when I was a kid, it's really simple Texas food, deviled eggs, meatloaf, chess pie.
All things that are on your menu.
All things that are on my menu. And it was really a natural fit, because as soon as I learned that Fess Parker had also spent the majority of his time growing up in San Angelo and Fort Worth, it just seemed like a very natural fit. I wanted the Bear and Star really to pay tribute to the ranch, and a huge part of the ranch is Fess Parker and the Parker family. So we needed to integrate that history, and the fact that my own history from a culinary standpoint mirrored that made it really exciting for me.
So when you moved to California, or maybe you didn't even think about it at your previous job at Post Ranch Inn, but here, and when they were, whenever you found out about Santa Maria barbecue, were you like, well, that's not barbecue, that's grilling? Because it's not low and slow.
Right. It's not low and slow. You do get some of the smoke influence, but yeah, I think it is a type of, it's a type of barbecue.
you'll accede to that point now that you've lived here long enough.
Especially now that I live in the valley. Yeah.
You have to, pretty much. That's funny. So, and another element that you have on your menu that I think really speaks to California and also to Hollywood history, which Fess Parker is a part of, is the Cobb salad.
Right.
And you do have it in quote marks on your menu.
Sure. So the, I don't know if, how much you want to know about the Cobb salad, but
yeah,
it actually originated in 1938 at a restaurant called the Brown Derby. And, it's really an interesting story because a lot of people think the Brown Derby was a single restaurant. It was actually a chain of restaurants that started off more or less as a bet by a bunch of kind of Hollywood big shots.
This part I don't know. The restaurant chain started as a bet?
Right. So that Brown Derby, it's kind of that iconic building that's shaped like a hat. And that was the original Brown Derby.
Yes.
And I think it was maybe Jack Warner from Warner Brothers Studios and the guy from the Chinese Theater. What was his name? Sid...
Grauman.
Grauman, exactly.
So yeah, I didn't know about Jack Warner, but Sid... Yeah, but probably. Yes.
So a couple of their friends got together and someone made a comment about eating food out of a hat. And it sort of evolved into this full-on restaurant concept that sort of fumbled around in the 1920s. And then... they actually met this Montana cowboy named Robert Cobb and
Bob Cobb.
Yeah. Bob Cobb. And, he was apparently, you know, a real good looking, tall cowboy who was very charismatic and was flipping burgers down the street, and they would occasionally get lunch there, and they felt like he would be a great face for this restaurant. So
yes. So he ended up being one of the founders.
Right. So they partnered him in, even though he wasn't the original founder.
Like, did they do it as a kindness? Like, he didn't have any capital to add
exactly
to the pot.
I don't think he had any capital, but I think he also knew something about the restaurant industry, which perhaps they didn't.
Okay.
So they had the money. He perhaps had that kind of showmanship.
Right.
They all had the showmanship, but he had the restaurant showmanship. And The restaurant was really known for those late nights. It was one of the 24-hour restaurants.
Right.
And it would get a lot of Hollywood people.
Right.
So, and especially because it was founded by Hollywood people and showmen.
And the fact that it was shaped like the hat, that was what's called programmatic architecture, which was so big in the teens and 20s, where people would build buildings that looked like some element of the menu. Like, so a lot of teacups in that day. They were shaped like teacups, a lot of barrels. And it doesn't have to be the building itself. You know, Randy's Donuts, which is sort of an iconic LA place. You always see pictures of it. It just has an enormous donut on the top of the building. And then also, if you named your restaurant something like the Bulldog Cafe, the building would be shaped like a bulldog. So the original Brown Derby, like you said, it was actually shaped like a hat. Did they? I think they only did it with the one, because like you said, it was a chain, but I think they only did the programmatic architecture with the first one.
I believe so. And then they incorporated into their signs later
on. Yes. And there is a Brown Derby restaurant that exists in some part of LA County. And they absolutely let people think that it's one of the original Brown Derbies. Oh. It's not. It's completely unrelated.
Well, and I guess in Florida, one of the Disney parks has actually licensed it. So they have the original Brown Derby menu still in place. But there's a lot of different stories about how the Cobb salad originated. But the one that I really like, and I think is probably the most accurate, is that Sid Gorman had recently had some kind of a dental surgery. And they had been out filming, probably drinking, maybe weren't in a great mood. They showed up at the restaurant, and perhaps the chefs were off, and somehow Bob Cobb got stuck making this food. And I can kind of see it, you know, from a chef's standpoint. You're ready to get out of there, and you're going back into the kitchen, and the owner partners are hungry. You grab some things out of the refrigerator, you chop it up on a cutting board, throw it into a bowl. I mean, I think we can all agree that Cobb salad is not the most finesse based dish we can imagine. But I think if you put avocado, bacon, blue cheese on anything, it's going to taste okay.
Yeah, you can't go wrong, essentially. Right. It's funny because, you know, that is the story they tell, that one of the guys had just had like dental surgery or had bad teeth. So they say that they made this salad because it was all soft foods. But at the same time, it's like a lot of rich flavors, a lot of heavy flavors. And it doesn't seem like something you would want having just come out of oral surgery or something. Which, speaking of which, we should, I'm sure some people aren't familiar what a Cobb salad is. The iceberg lettuce and the romaine lettuce and watercress was in the original recipe. And then blue cheese, it always says preferably Roquefort, bacon, hard-boiled eggs, tomatoes, and then boneless, skinless chicken breast cooked and cubed, which, like, that doesn't, like, if you say it that way, it doesn't sound great. And then avocado. And then it seems like the only seasonings, aside from what they probably called salad oil at the time in the 30s when the salad was invented, was just the salt, pepper, and chives.
Right.
So it's, you got to get the flavor from the bacon and the cheese, really.
Yeah, it's really simple. And one of the things that really struck me when I looked back at these historic menus, menus from the 40s, was that this wasn't, you know, today we think of the Cobb salad as like the lowest common denominator food. It's something you get for, you know, you're out to lunch, you just want a Cobb salad. But that wasn't the case back in the day. When you look at the menu, it was $2.25, which was more expensive than scallops. It was more expensive than halibut. This is one of the luxury items. This is like a thing to, you know, see and be seen. You go out, you have the Cobb salad. It almost means that you're in the know. You're part of this little clique of the Hollywood.
Yes. Events.
And they definitely priced it accordingly. So that was fascinating to me.
Totally. And I think that was a big part of what people went to the Brown Derby for. It was always star-studded. And they had a term. Okay, so at some point, all the Brown Derby restaurants, but especially the one on Vine, which is the one with the most celebrities went to, Vine in Hollywood, they offered tableside phone service. So that idea that you still sometimes see in movies that are like set in the olden days, where the waiter will bring you the phone to your table. So people would ask their assistants or whoever to call them when they were at the Derby. And that was called the Derby Derby. Because you just went and everyone was like working so hard and putting in so much effort towards looking like they were incredibly important. It must have been actually been an interesting place to be, though, because like a lot of it was fake. But hey, that's Hollywood, baby. Right.
Yeah, there's some great stories that came out of there. The filming of one of the I Love Lucy episodes. There's just a lot of history in those restaurants. And I think that's, you know, that really ties into I guess one of the reasons why we have the Cobb salad on the Baron Star menu is Fess Parker started out his Hollywood career right around, I think it was early 1950s, 1951.
Okay.
The I Love Lucy episode that kind of really shot the Brown Derby up into the more public ranks was in 1955, I believe. So really that window of when Fess Parker would have been really taking off in Hollywood was also when the Brown Derby would have been in its heyday.
And so, like nationally famous
exactly,
for the first time.
Nationally famous. Uh-huh. You know, Hollywood would have still been hanging out there. We know that Fess and Marcy used to love going there and getting the Cobb salad. So, you know, years later when they had this little inn up in Los Olivos, mm-hmm. and they had Restaurant Marcella, which was a restaurant that they used to run. And actually it used to be quite famous because they were really known for their hospitality. And one thing they would do is do a jazz night where they'd have a musician friend of theirs come in and they would just do a jazz sing-along. And a lot of their Hollywood friends would come up for the evening, stay at the inn, you know, sing in the bar. And they'd have these dishes like Cobb salad that were very nostalgic from, you know, their time that they spent in Hollywood. So that's been something that's been on and off here at the inn since the Parkers ran the restaurant themselves.
Oh, okay. But your Cobb salad isn't the traditional Cobb salad. You have some different elements.
Right. So we kind of do a modified Cobb salad, I'll say. Probably one of the biggest differences is that we use a smoked chicken breast. So just like with all of our...
You don't just throw it in water and boil it?
Just throw it in water and boil it. A lot of our dishes at the Baron Star are just what we like to think of as really good renditions of classics. Mm-hmm. And they're based off of products from our ranch. So mm-hmm. with the Cobb salad as an example, it might be... fresh eggs from our chicken coop. It might be watercress that we forage in the stream. We have bacon that we cure and smoke in-house. Mm-hmm. In fact, as a chef, you know, having done this for 18, 20 years, I've always had the idea that I was going to make my own bacon in-house. It's always been a project. And I'm sure other chefs can empathize with this, but you get a couple of weeks into it and you realize there's no way you're ever going to keep up. So this is one of the few restaurants that I've ever been able to keep up with our entire bacon production. And it's because we have a 40-foot smoker on the back patio.
It's a big one.
It helps a lot.
Yeah.
But the bacon is made in-house completely from scratch. A lot of the lettuces are harvested from the garden. So I think it's very true to the original vision of the Cobb salad. Mm-hmm. It's just maybe a little bit more refined.
Okay. And you put in the pickled onions, right?
We do.
And you told us earlier when you were giving us a tour of the farm that you have to let your onions set basically after you pick them, which I didn't know. And I feel like that's a good tip for a lot of home gardeners.
Right. Yeah. Who knew farming was so complicated? But I guess when you pull an onion right out of the ground, it still has that wet, almost, I would describe it as a resinous quality, where you have really strong allium, like kind of burn your nose. And mm-hmm. when you let them cure, you know, it might be as simple as just leaving them out in the field in the sunlight to sort of dry and have that outer peel get that nice kind of papery texture that we're used to seeing in grocery stores.
Yeah.
That's what we call curing onions. And during that process, the onion's flavor just mellows a little bit and kind of smooths out.
That is so interesting. I had no idea. Also, I have a very important bacon question for you. So you showed us the smoker earlier and you were talking about how you're pretty agnostic when it comes to the type of wood that you put into it, which is for environmental purposes, basically, it seemed like. And so when you're at the grocery store and you're looking at the bacon selections, and they often say like applewood smoked and sometimes hickory smoked and sometimes cherry wood. So does your bacon, it's just smoked with whatever? And then the second part of that question is are we all being tricked when they say like applewood and we think it's fancy, but it doesn't mean anything?
I think that's a good question. I do think that there are nuances in certain types of smoke, but I think the important thing to remember about all barbecue is mm-hmm. that barbecue is a very, you know, it's a very family, country, blue collar way of eating. This is not a food history that is, you know, from chefs or fancy restaurants. It's really what's available. So if you look at any barbecue region, you're going to see techniques and, you know, the type of wood, the type of meat, that's all going to be dictated by what's in the environment. So for Santa Maria barbecue, they're using oak. That's the same wood that we use simply because that's the wood that grows on the ranch.
Yeah.
If you go to the Perini Ranch in Texas, they're mm-hmm. going to be using mesquite mm-hmm. and they're going to change the way that they deal with that wood, that they use burn pits where they light the mesquite on fire, they burn it down to coals, and then they put it into the smoker, because the first part of that burning mesquite is where you get the acrid, astringent flavors. So they've adapted their process to the wood that they have on hand. We might use grapevines, we might use applewood. If we had a enormous supply of applewood, maybe we'd use that. But it's really what's available.
And it always tastes good, you feel like.
It always obviously. Tastes good. And I think you adapt the amount of time that you smoke and, you know, when you add the meats into the smoker. The type of wood that you use, is important in that equation.
Here's the thing about barbecue is that you have to be so nerdy about it to really get into it. It's so funny because you don't think about like pit masters and people standing around barbecuing as being huge nerds, but they're the biggest nerds. You have to know so many little details about every little part of it to do it well.
Yeah, I think there's definitely two camps of barbecue. You have the camp of barbecue where you get the real chefy nerds who are into the temperatures and the theory and everything else. And then you just get the people who have been doing it for generations, and they just do it the same way their dad did it, or the same way that the person who showed them did it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I think they're both,
that just means someone was a nerd before they came.
That's
along.
Right.
So I had sort of always assumed that Cobb salads were like in the chopped salad family. But apparently chopped salads weren't around until the 60s. Also from LA, it's funny because Angelinos are not healthy eaters. And I think people will hear us talking about these salads from LA and be like, oh, right, LA, they only eat salads. But think about what's in a Cobb salad and a chopped salad. They're nutritious, they're wholesome, but they're not exactly like healthy by a lot of measures. But anyway, chopped salad, I guess that comes from La Scala, which is another iconic, legendary LA restaurant. But not the same thing as a Cobb salad?
Yeah, I guess they're both kind of salads for people who hate salads, which is yes. funny. That explains yes. their popularity, I guess.
Yes, exactly. Because chopped salad, generally, when we're talking about them, like Italian-influenced ingredients, so salami and cheese and chickpeas and pepperoncini and stuff like that. That's what we both mean, right?
Exactly. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if that was sort of a derivative of the Cobb salad.
Yeah.
And who knows, there was probably a version of the Cobb salad before the Cobb salad that just wasn't as well recognized. I think everything's just a little evolution.
Totally. Totally. Absolutely. And it's kind of funny too, because another Hollywood point is that I think the daughter of the person who supposedly invented the chopped salad at La Scala, she's like, it wasn't, the reason like they chopped every bit so small was actually because they were in evening wear. Because it was a restaurant that you would go to all decked out to the nines. So you had to make salad easily and make sure there was no chance of like things spilling down your front, which is kind of cute. They kind of baby fooded up salad.
Yeah, it's so funny how both of those salads got their beginnings in that formal setting. You just wouldn't expect that at all.
Yeah, totally. So having said that, though, there are a lot of salads still available to people that are like a riff that I think kind of like move between Cobb salad and chopped salad, I think. Like, for instance, there's a third salad that's not nearly as famous, but it's from the Polo Lounge at the Beverly Hills Hotel. It's called the McCarthy salad. And that's romaine, grilled chicken, eggs, beets, tomatoes, cheddar cheese, smoked bacon, avocado, and balsamic vinaigrette. Actually, that sounds a lot more like yours, kind of. No beets in yours.
Right, no beets.
But the pickled onions kind yep. of add that color. And a little bit of the tartness. But that one sells for $35.
Wow.
That's an expensive salad.
It is.
What's the most expensive item on your menu?
Well, it depends on the day. The menu changes quite a bit. I would say right now the most expensive is the dry-aged Wagyu tomahawk chop that we do. It's definitely big enough for two people. So by the time it's dry-aged down for 3 or 4 weeks, it's probably a 24 ounces, so almost 2 pounds. And it's $110 to $120, depending on how large the chops end up being.
Mm-hmm. Okay, has anyone ever taken down one of those by themselves?
That's a good question. I don't know if they have, but...
Someone would have told you. Their server yeah. would have come in. Check this out. So have you ever had people like ask why you have like a Wagyu meatloaf? Why there's Wagyu in the burger? Does that ever blow people's minds?
I think so. People associate Wagyu with, of course, Kobe beef from Japan, which is one of the true culinary luxury ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And Wagyu just means Japanese cow.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of different types of Wagyu in Japan, but we have a very special bull on our property. We call him Bubba, but he's actually, his actual name is Akahiji 811U. And long story short, Katie and Rocky, who run the ranch and are Eli Parker's, Katie's Eli Parker's daughter, and she would be Fess Parker's granddaughter. She runs all the cattle program and the whole farm program. And they found Bubba at a bull auction about 7 or 8 years ago, I guess, maybe a little bit less than that. And it turned out that he was one of the highest rated bulls in the country.
Who decides that?
It's really based on how the carcasses get graded out. So a lot of times, especially in the Wagyu industry, where almost all the carcasses are grading out above the USDA grade of prime. So saying that a Wagyu is prime would be pretty much irrelevant because prime would be the lowest expectation of a Wagyu cut.
Uh-huh.
So the USDA grading doesn't really help Wagyu farms. So most of them are self-graded, I would say. So they're going to say each one of them has a different grading system. It might be by color.
Each farm,
exactly. Oh. So there may be like an A5, might be a Japanese style of grading, or some Australian producers might use that same grading. And so that's universal, but you get other Wagyu farms in the US that just use a color designation or a number designation, and they kind of do it on their own. So
it seems like that would lead to grade inflation.
Yeah, exactly. And in the case of Bubba, Rocky and Katie bought him when he was 3 years old, 3.5 years old, which means that none of his offspring had been old enough to get butchered. And so they hadn't been old enough to get graded. And since you're not going to grade a bull that's still walking around the pasture, no one really knew what kind of an animal he was. And it turned out when his first generation of his offspring started going to market, they were some of the finest marbled and largest primals that this particular ranch had seen. So they really wanted to get him back. And Katie and Rocky decided to continue the Wagyu program and bring in other animals to improve the genetics of the herd. And that's kind of how we got where we are today, is we have 120 head of Wagyu up on the property.
They're not all Bubba's kids, are they?
Right now, they're not. About 80% are his kids. And we're right now being very diligent about tracking, you know, who the mother is, who sired the offspring, so that we can improve the products. Because you really can't tell from looking at a Wagyu from the outside. You have to track it through the entire process.
Got it. And you introduced us to Bubba today, and we pet him, which, honest to God, I didn't know was a thing you could do with bulls.
he's the most gentle bull that I've, not that I've met a lot of bulls, but he's really a gentle bull.
Yeah.
And Rocky, who's used to be a professional bull rider, got him with the intention of maybe riding him around a little bit, maybe having the kids ride him, but he just refused to buck. All he wanted to do is sit in the yard and eat. So,
I mean,
he's a real Wagyu.
God love you. I get it completely. So, but you don't use just the big cuts of the Wagyu. You put them in like the ground beef and stuff because you've got the animals. You're going to use all parts of them.
Exactly. So that really is the challenge for, you know, we talk about being a ranch to table restaurant. Not a lot of restaurants are especially doing their own meats. It's a very daunting process to be fully sustainable with beef or lamb. We're able to do it. The challenge is that you have customers who really want that filet mignon. Well, you only get two fillets out of an animal.
Yeah.
Each fillet is 8 pounds. That's 16 pounds. You're getting a 1,000-pound carcass. What do you do with the other, you know, 984 or whatever it is, pounds of meat? When you get a lot of ground beef, you get a couple of ribeyes, which customers are going to order. You get some New Yorks, which customers are going to order. And then there's that gray area. So you get, if you're processing three cows and you get a hanging tender or two hanging tenders off of each one, do you save that or do you put that into the grind? Well, if you put it into the grind, what do you do with all that grind? So for us, it's finding that balance and engineering our menu so that the primal cuts, the fillets, the New Yorks, the ribeyes, the cuts that are going to go out as steaks are going to balance out with the ground beef. So we are always very excited, probably more excited than any chef should be, to sell burgers and meatloafs and jalapeno poppers. Any way that we can utilize ground beef is a happy menu item for us.
That makes a lot of sense. But of course, you don't always eat meat. I mean, beef. You right. sometimes eat a Cobb salad, which has like two other kinds of animals on it. That counts as switching things up.
Right.
Right?
It does.
But it's not a side salad. It's a meal unto itself.
Yes. We actually, I hope that one day our chickens and our pork could come from the property.
Mm-hmm. You don't have enough of them, right?
We don't. Right now we have 3 mangalitsa pigs. Mm-hmm. And that will hopefully turn into 15 mangalitsa pigs here in the next few weeks. And we have a lot of chickens, but they're pretty much just for eggs. So you do get the chicken eggs off the farm.
Yes. So there's that.
Which is exciting.
Do you make and do you use any of the eggs for desserts here?
It depends on how much we have. We actually really like using the duck eggs for dessert.
Oh, like in what?
In our chocolate cake, we've used them on occasion, sometimes in the chess pie. Oh. They just have a little bit more, actually a lot more richness than the chicken eggs.
Okay.
So we've had really good luck using them in there.
So even though you aren't like fully sourced from the farm, you're like putting elements into every course.
That's right. Our long-term goal is to get as much as we possibly can from the farm. I think a lot of farm to tables pretty much come down to, you know, a clever marketing campaign. I think it's actually such an oversaturated term that it doesn't even register with people anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But for us, we truly want the farm to play a big part in the restaurant menu. And that means really trying to ultimately offset as many purchases as possible. So if we have 500 quail eggs, we're going to change the menu to feature those 500 quail eggs. It's working with what we have in the moment.
That makes a lot of sense. Awesome. Well, John, thank you so much for your time with us today.
Oh, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Where should people follow you on social media?
So Chef John Cox on Instagram, and I might have a Twitter account. If I do, it's Chef John Cox. And Facebook might be the same thing.
Were you on did you do a Bobby Flay?
I did.
Something?
I did.
Throwdown with Bobby Flay. That's it, right?
Yeah, beat Bobby Flay, Throwdown, something like that.
And it already aired, right?
It did.
Did you win or did he win?
He, I don't know.
Did he cheat or did you cheat?
No, he won. And it was actually a lot of fun. He's such a nice, he's a really nice host. I know, you know, a lot of times he gets a bad rap with chefs, but I will say that he's incredibly good at what he does and that style of cooking.
Right.
He's so much fun to work with him in his kitchen. I also did acorn pancakes, which I think was a little bit of a risk.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like one. Had you had them before?
Yes, I love them. They're,
okay.
They're absolutely amazing. And he took so I did an acorn pancake with caramelized apples and a candy cap mushroom syrup.
Uh-huh.
So it was the most foodie, obscure version of pancakes that you could possibly do.
Yes.
And he decided to go the opposite route and do a carrot cake pancake with a cream cheese frosting.
Wait.
So.
Duh. So that one won?
I think the judges maybe were a little less culinarily inclined.
Yeah, obviously. So. You can't just see, but they do that on purpose. The producers know that that's going to win because it's such a slam dunk.
That's right. Hey, he's good at what he does.
Yeah. And that means good at TV production too. Not
that's
just
right.
cooking. Awesome. Well, I'm sure people will be able to see that because I think they run those episodes a lot on the Food Network.
Yes.
So.
And also keep an eye on PBS because we just did a Cooking with Fire with Stephen Reichel.
And, oh, cool.
That'll show some really, I hope it shows some really good scenes from up at the Parker Ranch. And that should be airing this summer.
Awesome. I'm definitely excited to look for that. John, thank you so much.
Thank you, Catherine.
There once lived a bull, a magnificent bull, in a pasture near old Barcelona. He would romp and he'd play through the flowers all day till he'd smell just like you, de Colonna. He was gentle and kind and his moo was refined, which the rest of the bulls all resented. For when he'd start to moo in a moment or two, he'd have all the cows discontented. Ferdinand, Ferdinand, the bull with the delicate ego. Ferdinand, Ferdinand, the heifers all called him amigo. Ferdinand, Ferdinand, he'd curtsy and greet them politely. Now he knew how to tango and dance the fandango, but he never learned to fight. Ferdinand, Ferdinand, the smiled when the picador faced him. Ferdinand, Ferdinand.